Welcome to episode 9 of This Catholic Life. Conversations about life's ups and downs, big and small, how we deal with every situation imaginable, whatever life throws at us, but still manage to be sensible, practical, and joyful. Today's show is Beauty Draws Us to God, a conversation about beauty in nature, art, literature, wherever it can reflect God or reveal God to us in some way and even draw us closer to God. I'm your host, Peter Holmes, and today I'm joined by Renee Coller-Ryan, my co-host and professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. Hello, Renee.
Hello, Peter.
And also Ryan Galliott, our artist, resident geek, and co-host for today.
Hello.
We want to remind you that you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and your favorite podcast apps. You can find all the links on our website and at thiscatholiclife.com.au. Now, the reason I'm saying that is that we've been really enjoying reading your feedback. We've been loving especially your ideas for new episodes. We're really keen on them. And we'll be rolling out some of those episodes in the near future because you've had some great ideas. Keep them coming. Let's dive right into today's topic. Beauty draws us to God. And we should begin by defining what we're talking about here. So before I go into the topic, I'll just say a word about why the people here are especially qualified to talk on this. We mentioned before, I think, in the podcast, Ryan, that you completed an honours year at Notre Dame.
Yes.
And your honours thesis was?
Beauty in video games.
Beauty in video games.
Yes, yes.
That's a pretty cool topic, especially it's not the place that most people would think we're going with this beauty topic, is
it? No.
And the cool thing about that is that Renee and I were actually co-supervising that thesis. Renee did the beauty part. I'm just going to quickly.
Yeah. Not the video game.
Not the video game.
No. Who has time for that kind of thing?
Real research.
And I'm very definitely not involved in anything to do with beauty. So, all right.
I've seen some nice pictures on your walls.
Yeah.
You
have
a beautiful family.
Yeah, so pictures
your
of other people
is
the way
right.
I do it. Yeah. That's the way I get away with it. I take pictures of very photogenic children and my wife, who is absolutely
She's
beautiful.
Gorgeous.
She is, yes. All right. Let's be honest, Renee, though. You have studied this topic a little bit over the years, haven't you?
Just a bit.
Yes. Yeah. So tell us more about that.
Well, in a nutshell, I wrote my master's thesis on beauty. So my starting title was What is Beauty and Where Is It Now? And then it morphed into a thesis on contemporary aesthetics, which was the beautiful, the ugly, the sublime, and beyond, Kant and postmodern aesthetics. So that was fun.
So in your thesis of Where is Beauty Now, I bet you didn't have video games as one of
your... No, I really did not, no. Mm-hmm. I was spending a lot of time in museums. So what got me interested in it, though, was that what struck me was that more and more people were moving toward art galleries as a kind of sacred zone rather than toward churches. And it really struck me once because I went to a wedding. I was in Vienna and I turned to someone at the dinner table and I said, so I've got a day in Vienna tomorrow. Tell me what I should see. And I was expecting a list of churches.
Right.
And instead I got a list of
art galleries.
Art galleries. And, you know, go see this. And I thought, well, I mean, I love art. I'm going to do that. That's a given. But tell me about the churches, because that's what you don't often read about. So I started to get into it that way. And then that led into my PhD then, because I became even more firmly convinced that that was what was going on.
Right.
So I wanted to talk about sacred space. I ended up writing my thesis on sacred space, which brought in Augustinian aesthetics.
There are two words which send terror into my heart. As someone who was an ex-Lutheran minister, when people said sacred space, it meant something utterly different to beauty. Anyway, let's go on. So what is beauty? Lots of debate about this, what's beautiful and what's not beautiful. Isn't it relative? Isn't it just what I find beautiful, or is there something that we can actually identify that's actually beautiful? Box.
No, I remember looking into this during the thesis actually, and just that a lot of the definition now goes down to you can only find something, whether something is beautiful, depending on how someone has reacted to it emotionally.
Right.
And there is a level of subjectivity to it, but there is also, I think, a necessary objectivity.
So you said emotionally there. Is beauty only in its power to cause us to have an emotion?
I think there's something there about its power to have cause a reaction in us.
Okay.
But I'm not sure about necessarily having to be emotional only.
I'm interested to know what reaction we could talk about that's not emotional.
Maybe a cognitive reaction.
Okay.
Something.
Yeah. Yep.
Lead us to contemplation.
So you might think something differently, or you might think you might have a different attitude to something because of the art. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. What do you think, Renee?
Well, I'm going to try not to get too theoretical here, right? So that's always the challenge. But to me, funnily enough, I find Augustine and Aquinas really helpful here. But Aquinas is helpful because he kind of nips that whole relativism thing in the bud a few centuries before it happens, because he says what that's right, preemptive strike. He's good at that, actually. So he says, well, the reason that we have this experience of beauty is that we actually come into contact with something which is beautiful.
Right.
So he points to the reality of what is going on. We can actually be mistaken, of course, and think, oh, that's beautiful. But then as we're learning more and more what beauty actually is, it's really ingrained in reality. And I think that that's something that the Catholic tradition really gives us. It's not this idea of, oh, what I find beautiful, well, you know, you might not find it beautiful. Well, then you're not actually talking about beauty as such.
Is it
something
though,
more than that?
There's something in the eye of the beholder, sometimes at least. So, for example, and then maybe,
it's always in the eye of the beholder as well. Yeah.
But I want to push it a little harder and say, okay, some people have introduced me to their new baby, and it's not my baby, so I'm kind of just looking with a certain amount of, you know, objectivity, I guess. And they say, isn't the baby beautiful? And I go,
every baby
really
is beautiful,
not.
Peter. What is wrong with you?
But look, to be honest, what you see.
You're losing listeners.
What you see when I've looked at my babies, some of them haven't been, like, those first moments of their outside life, so to speak, as they come out into the world, aren't always the most amazingly sort of photogenic moments.
I reckon you have to make a distinction here between beautiful and pretty.
That's a good distinction. Now, this is an interesting distinction, because I think that my point was is that when we see, especially our own baby, but other babies, when you can see the goodness, the wonder, the miracle that is a new human life, and you're rejoicing at this sort of, it's almost like God still hopes in our world, but a new soul comes into the world. That's what we're seeing in that case. Sometimes it's hard to see, for some people, it's hard to see beauty in such things.
Yeah. Well, the more you're capable of loving God and of being in a relationship with God, the more I think you're able to see as God sees.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, we'll never be able to do that, right? But the more you can see as God sees, and the more then you actually find beauty within the whole world.
So,
and that's a very Catholic thing to do as well. We find beauty in really weird places.
That's right. And one of the things that really surprised me in the study of beauty was the need on some level to, I guess, be educated.
Yeah.
Because the more you know, the more you're capable of understanding and therefore finding other things beautiful. I mean, you might look at the great works of literature in another language and not appreciate them, but then you learn the language.
Especially if you don't know the language.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, reading ancient Greek and not really appreciating the works there and having to struggle through that learning.
Yep.
But once you do, you realize and you value these works and see how beautiful they are.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to push that a little bit, because quite often I've been to art galleries and I've said, I don't like this. I don't think it's art, as in a particular piece. And someone said, oh, you're just not educated enough. You don't understand the true beauty that's
yes,
hidden.
But not all art, not all art is beautiful.
So is the pronunciation the key there?
Oh, yes. There's a wonderful Ab Fab episode, absolutely fabulous. Yes. Have you seen that one where she buys this piece of art and the friend comes in and says, what is it? And she says, well, I paid a lot of money for it and it's art. And they both went, okay. It's art, darling. It's art. Okay.
How do we distinguish that? I mean, you do need to hone your senses in some sense.
So, that's right.
So you're either intellectual, but also you get used to certain things. And often it's about comparisons, because, for example, you can see in a piece of art, oh, that's like a sunset, or that particular blend of colours represents this or something like that. But
sometimes art is purely conceptual. So we went to the gallery this last weekend because the exhibition on Duchamp, Marcel Duchamp, who died in 68, which I hadn't sort of thought about before. But anyway, really interesting figure. He's the one who came up with the ready-made. So he took a urinal, wrote it, signed it with someone else's name, put it in a museum and said, this is art. And that threw everyone into a tizzy, because actually what he was doing, I think, was pointing out some of the problems with the art world at that point. And he has some, I could go on about him, of course, but what I found with my research into contemporary aesthetics was that it was not about beauty anymore. No. It was about asking questions. It was about provoking. And so it had actually taken the whole experience of art outside of the perceptual, and it's more about getting inside the head of the artist. That's what I talk to my students about. I don't know if I've griped you about it, Box. My apologies if I do, if I have. But more and more contemporary aesthetics is about what is it that the artist sees? And then he or she has to give you a really long explanation about how completely amazing this is, because this is what they think. And I'm just don't want to be thinking about the artist. I actually want that engagement with the artwork.
Right.
And that's been a huge shift.
We are going to have this conversation about music in a later episode, because I have the same discussion about music.
Yeah.
If someone has to explain how wonderful something is it really, is the point what they're trying to say? And it is to some extent, but is the point what it evokes in me?
Yeah, and you should be able to get lost in a real work of art.
So what's the point of art then?
Well, can I just draw it back to another point, which is something we were talking about, beauty, I think, for Catholics, beauty has to be, you have to take on board the point that Ratzinger makes when he talks to artists, which is that the crucifixion is the most beautiful object of contemplation for us. Yeah. And that is a complete paradox.
Yeah.
So ancient thought was all about proportion and symmetry. And, you can think about Michelangelo's David. Yeah, the structure and everything. Everything is just balanced and wonderful. But for us, we look at Christ on the cross,
right,
and that is beauty. So that completely flips everything around again in the Catholic understanding of beauty.
Could I push that in relation to the question of what is art? When I was a Lutheran, some people criticized artists who would portray the cross with roses on it and, sort of beautify the cross or make Christ sort of pretty. And we saw Mel Gibson's The Passion, and it's an ugly scene. Mm. And yet the beauty of the cross is in some ways more visible when the true ugliness of the situation is portrayed clearly.
But Box, I can see you chafing at the bit over there.
Go ahead.
Just talking about Ratzinger, I mean, I was reading an article from the church itself, one of those ones and they actually chose to use this thing that Ratzinger subscribed to, which is called the via pulchritudinis, the way of beauty. And it comes down to three avenues in which the church sees beauty as a way to God. Right, and Christ is the center of it always. So the first way is the beauty of creation, and that really, because it's unique to us as humans, that we can actually contemplate and reflect on creation and see the beauty that's there.
Right.
But then we also have the beauty of the arts, where we, as creatures, are able to manipulate what has been created.
And part of the beauty there is that we're actually imprinting, we're putting a piece of ourselves into that as well.
Yeah, and participating in that way. And each step seems to be getting closer and closer to this being of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And the final one is the beauty of Christ. And included in that is our ability also to model our lives up to Christ. So we become beautiful. We have beautiful lives ourselves.
And, always that moral dimension, I think, in the Catholic understanding of beauty as well, which I find quite
beauty
often.
Beauty and goodness.
Yeah. It's missing very much from the contemporary imagination.
So we talked about beauty before about art evoking a reaction in us. Is the value of art then, or is one of the values of art, the fact that it actually transforms us?
Yeah, well, I think art is, it should transform us. It should form us in understanding more and more what reality is about.
Okay.
At the very least, what contemporary art does is that it makes us question. And I think that that's always a good thing.
Yeah.
But then it's a different form of art than what it was before. It's no longer about beauty. Yeah. And many contemporary artists would say that. So if we wanted to talk about beauty, we actually need to go elsewhere.
Mm.
And I think that that's actually where religious art or art which is being created by those who have a religious sensibility really have a lot to offer, because that's very much missing from most of the contemporary discourse.
So here's where I'm going with this, and this is the reason I've asked about the reaction. Some of the most clever artists, or at least graphic designers and artworks, are now being created by advertisers. And their intention is very clear in their visual grabs and their attempt to grab us. So there's a huge amount of money goes into, for instance, ads that go in the Super Bowl or things like that. And, of course, video games. But when we're talking about the actual art, it has a direct intention, and that's to get us to buy the product. So well, boxes grinning over
yeah,
there.
Yeah, you go, box.
No, I mean that reminds me very much of Ratzinger, Benedict XVI, and JP II,
mm-hmm.
who had this strong idea of true or authentic beauty,
right,
and false and unauthentic beauty. And the true beauty actually opens you up; it shocks you and wounds you,
right,
because it draws you into a deeper reality.
Okay,
something that actually it hurts because you realize how imperfect you are beside this perfect thing, and so
right.
It makes you want to be better. And then there's this false or unauthentic one, which does the opposite. It closes you into yourself and makes you desire to dominate, desire power. And they actually liken it to, I think it was Ratzinger, likened it to the apple in the Garden of Eden.
Okay.
And actually brings it into, in comparison to advertising today, making
right.
us desire something.
And that's not true beauty is his point. So if you're trying to sell something, you're no longer talking about true beauty.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys are the experts, but let me push this to you. There has to be something good in the image they're portraying in order to entice us. Because if it's not actually good or beautiful at all, or if they're not even trying to represent something. So even those ads, like those horrendous ads, I don't know if they run anymore, but for that spray-on deodorant that claims if you spray it on, you're suddenly surrounded by gorgeous women chasing after you. There's still a kind of an objective.
Yeah, it
sounds
work.
Like a nightmare.
it doesn't work the way I tried.
Why would you want lots of women chasing after you? You just need one.
Now, there's a certain amount of humor deliberately in that ad, but what interests me is that they portray this image so powerfully that everyone knows it's bollocks, right?
Mm.
And yet, it's the number one selling deodorant in Australia, at least, and probably
maybe it's just good deodorant.
It's not. It's vile.
Really? I mean, I don't think it is. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I obviously don't use male deodorant.
Yeah. And obviously hasn't affected you.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but again, television. So
every guy that's walking past, thought experiment once, I just stood in the aisle for about an hour and just watched from the end of the aisle. And guys walked past and looked at the brand and went, and then kept walking. And half of them came back and went, And you could hear their brain going, maybe, getting it. So there's a power of that image, if you like, that sort of evoked some sort of yearning in them, which goes beyond their rational mind saying this is completely not true, and yet art has a power to draw me away from what's true.
Yeah, I mean, this is just me questioning here. Is it because of that objective part of beauty, where there's something that is objectively beautiful to us anyway?
Right.
And so what it is that how it's used, the intent it's used for, is what changes. I mean, John Paul II really looks at that in The Theology of the Body, where the difference between pornography and you know, a statue that's nude is the intent of the artist.
Okay.
Whether it's to observe the beauty of the human body.
Yep.
Or to titillate.
Okay.
And
could it be also in the eye of the observer? Like, could someone look at the statue of David and use it in a kind of a vicious way or something?
I mean, there is that margin for error, I think, that I remember looking into, which is that anyone, depending on how much they are able to observe or know about the subject, might only see the surface level.
Okay. Yep.
You know, and not see the depth of what's behind it. So even in pornography, a person could look at that and see the depth of the beauty of the human person. But
but be horrified at the misuse of that.
Yeah,
human
and
person.
Be horrified, yeah. But at the same time, a person may look at, you know, one of the statues in the Vatican and go, ooh, you know. So
I have to say, I look at that statue and say, isn't the human person an amazing, complex creation? You couldn't, like, if you were designing it from scratch, it would look too ludicrous to feel like it would be beautiful.
And I actually don't like that statue, so I'm an outsider in the whole thing. I prefer Bernini's David.
Oh, okay.
Because Bernini's David it's fantastic because he shoots it. It's not like David naked and victorious, just sort of there like some kind of Greek god, but it's David pulling back the sling and he's just about to let it loose.
Oh, wow.
And he's concentrating. And it's him in this moment of human action that I just find completely captivating. And there's not that focus on bodily form, but instead on a kind of moral, spiritual action, which I find really, really lovely. Yeah, so I usually provoke my students by talking to them about that. But I think what you were talking about earlier with, or what you were asking about as well, Peter, with advertising and all of this kind of thing. Augustine talks about that, of course. So there's the kind of lure. For him, it's the theatres.
Did he use the spray on deodorant? No, sorry.
No, just he didn't. But he's talking about spectacle. So spectacle, which draws us away from who we actually are, and it kind of, and it scatters us. It scatters us out into the world. And so there are all of these images that just won't fit together because they're not actually what about what God is about. But he says when you come across better beauty, if you want to put it that way, so you come across beauty in creation, you might be tempted then to think, okay, now I've really found the answer to what is the most beautiful. And then he says, well, no, you have to go further than that. You have to say, okay, I'm looking at the stars, I'm looking at the oceans, I'm looking at the birds, that they're amazing. And then I have to say, well, who made them? And I go that part further. And I've been reading because I've been writing a paper for a conference, and there's he gives an enarration of Psalm 145. In which he says, I was looking at the translation and I didn't like it. And I figured out what he actually means is pull yourself together. And the way that you pull yourself together is by figuring out what beauty is all about and figuring out what the spiritual dimensions of beauty are through the physical. But if you're only taking the physical as though that's it, and that's what a deodorant ad will do, or that's what, you know, anything that's just trying to get you to put money into someone else's account isn't about actual full-on beauty, it imitates it. So it's taking you away from beauty, but in the same way, it could draw you in if you start to ask more questions about why you find it beautiful.
Could you say then that the power of beauty, through beauty, is to draw us deeper into the reality of what's real and
what's
good about that thing that you're observing, and beyond it to God.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, let's push it harder because, Box, we've talked about computer games and beauty in computer games. if we've talked about how deep reality is in it, computer games literally construct a false reality.
A reality, like an
illusion, a fiction.
And sometimes that reality in video games is more visually beautiful.
Yes, very much so.
Then, I mean, I remember playing Red Dead Redemption 2 recently and seeing the sunsets and sunrise in that, you know, in the country, in the wilderness, camping out, you know.
It's kind of more real than real.
Yeah, and it's beautiful. And I hate to say it, but also even in GTA, Grand Theft Auto 5, which is a very, very
controversial
game in the circles that I go around, there are some very beautiful landscapes in that game. And it's one of those things.
There's actually, after people will remember the Avatar movies, there was actually a phenomenon I saw written up in a psychological journal that they had post-Avatar depression. So people went into Avatar and the colors were so vivid and the reality, so-called, that was created in the movie was so vivid that after it left the cinemas, there were some people who'd watched it and watched it and watched it. And when they came out into the world, there's the old joke of the gamer, I tried reality. The graphics are amazing, but the gameplay sucks because you don't get to be this amazing hero.
I thought Avatar stank because there was no narrative. Yeah. It was just lots of blue people running around in this wilderness type place. It was like a sugar high.
That's right, Dances with Wolves.
Dances with Smurfs.
That whole thing of coming out and being despondent, it's like my kids after having too much sugar.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my gosh, that was amazing. Oh, life sucks. Well, maybe you shouldn't have had so much sugar.
the artist in me wants to speak on that just briefly, because one of the things that designers do when they create those extra worlds is they look at what we have in real life and imitate them. So we might see an alien world, but there's something familiar about it.
There has to be a connection, doesn't
there? Yeah, and because they've also used what's familiar to us, we can look at a surface and go, oh, that's going to be a hard surface.
Yes.
And so we know the unfamiliar from the familiar.
So they might have one of those in Avatar, they had that six-legged sort of cat thing, but it still looked very much like a cat, and the only difference was it had six legs. Mm. I've watched all of the Star Trek things, and it's, you know, the aliens, very alien, but they've always got two legs or, you know, they've got something which we identify with.
That's right. And I think, bringing it back to an earlier point when we're talking about the beauty of creation and the beauty of the arts, there's something there where the beauty of the arts that the artist has managed to manipulate and create from what's there or from nothing to present something of beauty, something that creates a longing in us, I guess, and our capacity to contemplate, which you can see in the beauty of creation, our capacity to contemplate what is and how familiar that is to what we know.
Mm.
allows us to really step into a desire, a deeper desire for us.
So stepping in, that's a good inroad into the computer game world, because one of the differences about the computer gaming appreciation of beauty is that you're in it.
That's right.
And so
that's
the immersive quality of computer games. So for example, the more recent Assassin's Creed game, Origins, I think.
The recent one is Odyssey.
Odyssey.
Odyssey, yes.
It goes back into ancient Egypt, and the amount
Origins.
Of research that they've done on ancient Egypt and the immersion into that culture and everything that happened and the pyramids and the beauty of the culture and some of the ugliness was so great that they actually, under pressure, released a non-violent version, so when there's no assassins or anything, just the educational version of that you can buy, and the school kids can walk around in the pyramids and watch an embalming. And
I've had a look at that actually, because I've got it at home, and you can actually play the role of a character.
Right.
And you go around and live the different lives, the different types of lifestyles.
So in terms of an education tool, but also the appreciation of beauty, instead of it being outside, you're inside. So for instance, in Second Life, which is a very, very old platform, but it's still got an immersive quality to it, someone has created, you know, 18th century Paris.
Yeah.
And you can walk around in 18th century Paris. This is not a reality I could do in any other art form. I've got a friend who, a dear friend who's doing her thesis in art in virtual reality. And now there's a piece of art called The Garden of Earthly Delights, I think it is, and it's part of a triptych. Is that?
Yes.
I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
But she's taken the middle panel of that, where there's this incredible detail and quite a little bit of ugliness where sin is being portrayed as coming into the world. And she's actually made it into a Second Life event where you can walk through and the characters all say a little line to you and they speak to you and react to you. So she's had to think about all the different characters and whether, and it's just an amazing thing in terms of art, immersive art.
Well, it's interesting, tying that back into Assassin's Creed, if I may. Assassin's Creed 4, Assassin's Creed Unity, sorry, it was set in Paris.
Right.
The time of revolution and stuff like that. But it's funny, unfortunately, with the destruction of Notre Dame Cathedral that we have now, there are actually two sources apparently of blueprints or of visual, blueprints that they're using to rebuild the cathedral.
Right.
Apparently, one of them is a laser scan of the site, and the second is Assassin's Creed Unity.
Because they looked at it so closely.
They painstakingly, one person spent a year apparently recreating Notre Dame Cathedral in this game to be accurate. And so it's now one of the sources. And, you know, it's amazing seeing that. The latest Assassin's Creed Odyssey, actually goes back and revisits ancient Greece. And so seeing the beauty then, we were talking earlier about learning about Greek, you know, language and culture. And to revisit that with modern understanding, but seeing how things were, there's a certain beauty that I would not have gotten from just learning.
And being immersed in it, especially I think that's very much applicable to the modern mind, because we're experiential is really the way to go.
Yeah.
And we're able to step into that reality. There is a limit to it, of course, but Notre Dame gives us a nice segue into the next part about beauty in church, or beauty as a deliberate act of an attempt to do something religious, if you like. I think I've told the story on a previous podcast about me going into a Russian Orthodox church, and I had a bit of a go at the priest at the time because I was an
iconoclast.
Yes, an iconoclast. I was going to say Protestant. But,
Oh, sometimes it's sort of the same.
And I said, aren't your parishioners distracted by all this art on the walls? And he said, I'm not so arrogant as to believe that my homily is the only way they can be taught. That if they look over here, St. Peter preaches a homily in this art and so on, and all over the roof, there's homilies everywhere. Which is, I guess, I'm going to throw to you, Renee, on this. How does beauty, not just in history, but how does it unfold in our understanding of God, and what role does it play in our appreciation of and relationship with God?
Well, it's absolutely essential, and beautiful liturgy is the most immersive human activity that there actually is. So all of the stuff with the video gaming world and all of this immersive stuff, I think, is actually picking up on something that the church has been doing for millennia now, which is bringing us into a beautiful space and then immersing us in words, but also in images. And then
sounds.
You've got the incense and the sounds, the gorgeous music, everything else like that.
Mm.
And the architecture, when the architecture marries with beautiful liturgy, then you really have something going on. So it can really feel like you're participating in the heavenly Jerusalem. For a long time, the idea was that in an illiterate society or a society where there just weren't enough books around, the church was a book. Yeah. So you would walk in and you would have the whole story of creation and redemption in there. And that would be with the stained glass windows. It might be with frescoes. It would be with the shape of the whole building.
Yeah.
And then when you bring liturgy into it, then it just makes it all come alive. So,
right.
Yeah, so I think that it's absolutely essential to that movement toward God.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is that it will, the liturgy together with all of the beauty of the architecture and the art will summon up in us a greater desire for a fuller unification with God.
Okay, so could we do that with an art gallery? I'm kind of pushing the sacred space thing now.
Well, it depends on what's going on in the art gallery.
Okay.
So it depends, I think, on the artwork. Mm. But it's never going, well, actually, it can be immersive, but it's usually not immersive with a religious sensibility.
Okay.
So we took the kids down to Melbourne over the last school holidays and went to the National Gallery of Victoria because they had the Terracotta Warriors.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, they had 8 of the Terracotta Warriors and lots of artifacts. And at the same time, they had a contemporary artist whose name I cannot recall.
Mm-hmm.
We could put that in the show notes as well, I suppose. But what he did was that he was a Chinese artist and they got him to do some installation work. I think that's the closest that it comes within an art gallery where you've got a whole space that's dedicated to a particular work. And it's when you enter into the space that it starts happening.
I'd venture to say that the one thing that really differentiates the church to the art galleries is its capacity to really enter into the three roads that the Via Pulchritudinis speaks about. Because the beauty of the creation, I mean, the structure of the church representing all of creation to lead our eyes, you know, up and beyond. And then you've got the beauty of the arts there in the liturgy and all the things that surround it. And then the beauty of Christ centered on the Eucharist.
Yeah,
I was going to say that's the key, isn't it?
That's the
difference for me between an art gallery and the church is that the church is actually pointing to something that's there.
That's right.
That Christ is there in the Eucharist.
Well, I mean, one might argue that they can find a similar thing in an art gallery.
Inspiration, certainly.
I would say that not as definite as in a church during the liturgy.
If you did have that in an art gallery, it would be pointing you to the church.
Yeah, that's right.
So in terms of the place, All right. So what about ugly art? I went to the, just to kick it off, I went to the art gallery in New South Wales here. I've been to the Melbourne one as well. It was an interesting experience because they did it chronologically rather than in European, Australian sort of sections. But in the modern art section of the New South Wales art gallery, there was almost an entire wall of one painting which covered, you know, it would have been way too big to be a family dinner table. Probably double that, and it was just brown. It was just brown. There wasn't a stripe. There was just brown, this entire wall.
Mm.
Now, I had to say, they are taking the mickey. This is just, I mean, seriously, how can you say this is art when, you know, I could hand my youngest child a brush and they'd do a Jackson Pollock or something like that, and it would be more interesting than this just brown. Mm. And there's this little spiel about, oh, how this is a profound reflection on the banality of culture or something.
Mm.
Could that be argued to be art?
I mean, I've got a bit of a bad history there. I went to art school.
Sorry, did you paint the brown thing?
I went to art school and I spent about 5 years there. And I remember being told to my face that my art wasn't art. It was illustration because only abstract art was art.
Oh.
And I was told that illustrators should be shot on site.
Oh, wow.
And so it was a very, very
confronting.
Strong, very
confronting
argument.
Yes.
And so...
Well, your art evoked a reaction.
Yeah.
So
but the funny thing is we had these exhibitions and...
Everyone wanted to look at your art, right?
Hey, there are other artists here too.
Is that the old line, I don't know about art, but I know what I like?
Yeah. And so what I did is we were supposed to write like a half page, you know, detail of just who we are, why we make art. And I just wrote a one page rant about why can't my stuff be considered art?
Ooh.
I use the same materials, the same techniques. Mine's just a bit easier on the eyes or easier to understand. And I remember one of the art technicians came up to me and said, you know what, your stuff is art now because you've posted that. And I said, really?
Right.
Now it's
yeah,
art.
So that gets back to the artist being the center. Yeah. Rather than
so
the
you're
artwork
ironically
being the center.
Posting
yeah.
old fashioned art as a statement. That's
no,
awesome.
It's not old fashioned art.
Well, see, this is the thing about walking through the Melbourne Art Gallery when they had it.
Perhaps,
they had it in chronological order. You could see the fragmentation happening. You started out with profound realism. And even people like William Bougereau, who I've just horribly mispronounced, was a throwback to earlier realism, but you can trace from the realism into impressionism and then into, you know, all the other styles. My kids are currently doing their trek through artists as part of their schooling, and I come home and I've been seeing a progression of paintings. You know, you have the cubism, and they've tried to make them into funky things, but they just look a bit disjointed. And then they just did a Jackson Pollock interpretation, and I asked my son, "Oh, that's very clever. What do you call it?" And he said, "Physically and mentally disturbed." He's not a Jackson
Fair
Pollock
enough.
Fan, yeah. But the point is that it seems as if our development in art has become less and less connected with reality.
It's but that's because we've become less and less connected with reality.
So could someone argue that it's actually a true reflection of the modern mind?
I think that it's an expression of what's going on in the contemporary mind. So there's this sort of plurality of expressions. I think you can look at the way that contemporary art progressed and you can see that it really was reflecting the different ideas that were going on at the time.
Right.
And some of these artists, a bit like you, Box, would write manifestos and say, well, this is why my art is the way that it is. So the futurists have that fantastic manifesto where they're saying, okay, and this is what art is about now because we are in the age of the machine and everything is about the machine and the future and everything else like that. And you could see with cubism, there's a fracturing. So I often think of the cubism that comes out of Picasso as a result of what's happened during the world wars where there's this fracturing of the self. So everything is kind of split apart and you can't quite grasp what exactly is going on anymore. You can see it from lots of different angles, but it's not really coming together as a whole. Mm. It's not. And so I actually think that I have a lot of time for cubism and abstract expressionism, Pollock even, also Rothko, the way that Rothko is able to work just so amazingly with color and these huge canvases.
Mm.
And we might look at them and think, oh, well, it's just three blocks of color. But that's usually because we're looking at a reproduction of a reproduction that's on a screen. Whereas if you actually walk into an art gallery and you see the work on the wall and you go close and up enough to it, and he was very fussy about lighting. So if they've listened to him about the lighting and you get close up enough to it and you just are still enough to really engage with the painting, his whole idea about color and the imagination and the way that we can be drawn in is really immersive.
Yeah.
And I think it's quite powerful. And he's looking for a kind of sublime experience that would take us away from a lot of the everydayness that really can be even more confronting than some of the artworks themselves. So,
it could be.
Yeah.
It's also the experience that some people had when they snorted some substances.
Well, and that has been talked about as well, that they were, you know, people were getting high on art and high on substance abuse as well.
Sniffing paint.
I'm sure that's what you were talking about. We still got
We
still got our, what is it? Is it, are we, R, no, we're MA rated. So we can talk about substance abuse.
I'm not sure if you've heard of a man, a philosopher named Hayden Ramsey.
Mm.
But I remember reading a book of his, just a chapter of the book, I've got to confess, called Reclaiming Leisure.
Oh, yes.
And there's this brilliant chapter in there about music.
Right.
And I strongly consider that an art form. And he was talking about historically how music, you didn't even have to be able to play a musical instrument originally to be considered a musician. But music was about contemplating music and leading into a moment of sublime.
So the listener was, in fact, the end game.
Yeah, well, the listener was a musician just by contemplating and it was a really interesting read going through the history of music, looking how everything was about leading to that sublime experience and how it's only recently that we've really started to look at, well, what did you intend for this?
Mm.
And I think at the moment we're talking about this stuff with art. We're at a stage now where there's a lot of art that sits right in the middle.
Right.
That leads us to a contemplation, but we also take part of the artist's response
to help
guide us.
Isn't it interesting, by the way, that artists are moving more and more towards explaining their art as part of their artwork, and musicians, if you ask them about their lyrics, they'll almost always hedge their bets and not want to explain it because they want to leave the interpretation as wide open as possible. Maybe that's partially commercial because they want to appeal to as many people as possible, but they're definitely leaving the interpretation open. Does the interpretation aspect of it, and especially the difference between music and art, is that something that's touching on what you're talking about there?
I think so. I mean, the interpretation is an interesting thing because just like the artwork itself, it can lead us to further contemplation or a different reaction to the artwork. And I think it all comes down to that subjective element of does the viewer want to enter into this? Like I mentioned before, there is that aspect where there is an objective good, objective beauty.
Right.
But it has to be partnered with that subjective approach and element, that the viewer and listener brings in, which is, I guess, what we've spoken about.
Mm.
I was reading, so I got my latest copy of the Image Journal, which is a journal on art, faith and religion. Something like that. Anyway, it's now edited by James K.A. Smith, who's a really interesting theologian, not a Catholic theologian, but a theologian. And in there was an interview with a poet, and the interviewer said, well, what is it about poetry, about the whole act of creating poetry that really strikes you? And the response was, well, when I am writing poetry, it's the moment where I really feel that God is working in me and through me, because I'm fully there. And yet, so I'm fully myself, but at the same time, there's something else that is happening in me. And I think that kind of creativity, which I'm sure you've experienced, I was thinking about that afterwards, that sometimes there are moments like that in teaching that I find, or in reading.
The word inspiration. Something's breathing through you.
Yeah, exactly. And it reminded me too of Flannery O'Connor, so the great Southern writer in the United States, who, when she was writing, she would always say, well, she didn't actually know where the characters were going to go. So she'd start off with this character, and then the character would kind of come to life, and she was just writing down what was happening. So she was creating, but at the same time, something was being created through her. And someone said to her, well, when do you know to stop? And she just says, look, I never know when it's going to happen, but I know that if I did anything more to it, it would all fall apart.
Right, okay.
That's when I know that I can stop and it's done.
Right.
So all of that kind of process of creativity, I think, is really interesting in terms of what we're talking about, and beauty as well.
All right. Well, let's bring it home. What do Catholics, how do we go about this? How do Catholics change the culture? Or perhaps, how do we enhance that aspect of our appreciation of beauty? What's our approach to art? What do we do in churches? That sort of thing.
Oh, that's a tough one. I don't know. I mean, I do it through my art.
Okay.
That's me personally.
But not everyone's as talented as you.
And not everyone's, of like mind or like talent. Yep. So I guess I'd never really explored that because I only know my own experience.
I mean, this is really crass because my father was an artist, and because he was really, really good, I did the typical thing and didn't go that way. But whenever I see art I love, I just can't help sharing it with people and saying, this is good, this is amazing, look at this, this is so cool. Mm. And then I'm looking to see what their reaction is because it's not the same as my reaction.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting.
What do you think, Renee?
So what do I think about what?
About what we should be doing. Like, what's the Catholic attitude to art, and is there something we can be doing to
The great thing about being Catholic is that there are always lots of different attitudes and lots of different ways of doing things. You could go back into the Middle Ages and look at the dispute between Bernard of Clairvaux and Abbot Suger, where one was saying, make it more and more glitzy, and the other was saying, no, stark and symmetrical.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get distracted. Oh, no, totally get distracted, to the point where you're taken out of this world and somewhere else. So there are always going to be disputes like that.
Mm.
But I think if we're looking at what's happening today, I teach aesthetics every second year.
Right.
And I always make sure that I do something with my students, which takes them to somewhere where they haven't been before. So right. I was taking students to the art gallery who had never been there before.
Right.
Yeah. I would take them through churches. I've taken them to plays. We should probably go to a concert sometime. I don't know. But there's always something going on around in Sydney. We're very, very spoiled because there's always something going on. Mm. And I think just making it, the problem, and different art theorists have talked about this, the problem with contemporary art that is that it's been taken out of everyday life and put somewhere else. So it's like you're only the hoity-toity will go off to the art gallery, but it should actually be for everyone. Yeah, right. And I think that just fostering an engagement with the arts and having people not be afraid to talk about them. So I don't like this. Okay, well, why don't you like it? Or I love this. Well, why do you? So giving them the
that
language.
That discussion itself is an amazing thing.
Yeah, and I think that way it might generate the appreciation of the arts a little bit more.
They had
well.
Just, I'm going to wrap it up soon, but we had a slightly controversial thing happen at World Youth Day here in Sydney. There was a competition for artists. They actually took a whole bunch of blank statues of the Sacred Heart and invited artists to compete to see who got the prize of painting it up well. But most of the artists weren't terribly religious, and so we got quite a range of things. Some of them were, you know, one of them had a Mexican death mask on it, like Spider-Man or Darth Vader. You know, there were all these quite horrific sort of renditions of the Sacred Heart. And, of course, some people who are used to seeing quite beautiful renditions of the Sacred Heart statues were very offended by this because they were taking something sacred and making it profane.
Reappropriate.
And even worse than profane, they were actually desecrating it in that sense. And I was intrigued. I still don't know how I feel about this, but some people actually went on rescue things. They actually bought the statues back, the worst ones, and then had them beautifully repainted and reconditioned. And then they went into various churches and places of worship or other religious places. It intrigued me that it wasn't just that it was some artwork I didn't like, but it was taking something I love and profaning it with art. Mm. Again,
well, it wasn't with art, though. It was just profaning it.
This is an excellent question. Yeah. I haven't actually thought it through in great detail, but there was a lot of people who got very agitated about it. Yeah. And I remember thinking, we're talking about art. This is an amazing thing. And we're talking about what the purpose of art is and what the end result is.
Yeah, but we're also talking about sacramentals. And that's something that doesn't, that needs to enter into that kind of conversation as well. Opening it up to people who don't actually understand what a sacramental is or actually hate the idea of a sacramental is a mistake. That's not something should be happening. That's where I think we learn a lot from the Eastern tradition, don't we, Box? So that whole, the icon painting tradition, where it's this prayer for this deeply
the
prayerful
process
activity.
Itself. Yeah, the process. And that I know that when I make my art, it is my expression of prayer as well.
Yeah.
I remember, if I may just a quick
even
story.
Even when you draw Spider-Man?
Well, Jesus is my superhero.
Oh, no. Oh, no. He went there.
I still want to find one of those T-shirts for my son. For maybe both of my sons, but the where you see all of the superheroes lined up and Spidey is swinging down and Jesus is in the middle.
And that's how I saved the world.
That's right. And they're all like, oh!
No,
sorry, you
I remember
were saying.
I was one particular, I think I drew it about a year or two ago. I painted it on my iPad and it was of the resurrection.
Oh, yeah.
And shock horror, I painted not only the five wounds, but I painted the scourging, the marks of the scourging on his back. And a lot of the non-practicing Catholics and non-believers that I encountered at uni were really interested and got into a lot of conversation with me about it. And some Catholics, not all, but some Catholics actually came up to me and said, how dare you paint him with the marks of the scourging? It was only the five wounds that were still there after the resurrection. And it was a really interesting theological conversation that came about. So It was a really good conversation with those who weren't practicing and those and they accepted it and really wanted to ask more. But then those who were practicing started engaging in what knowledge they had.
And so this up the back of the St. Benedict's Church at Broadway, there's a statue of our Lord. And what I noticed about it when I first went there, and I started just kneeling and praying there, Christ's knees are bloody. And it's one of the first statues I've seen where his knees have explicit sort of wounds. And I thought, when did he get bloody knees?
When he fell over.
When he fell carrying the cross, but also maybe in the garden when he was praying. Mm. You know, there's the kind of, and there was a couple of images we were competing in. Already, as you said, the art has drawn me into a contemplation of it.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Well, we're getting to the end of the podcast, so now it's time for, and we've talked about so many wonderful things, but now we have to pick out something else that's a one-minute wonder. So let's restrict it. Let's see what we can fit into 1 minute. You're off, Box.
Well, I've recently had a cause to reflect on my morality. Mortality.
We better get that straight.
My mortality.
Sometimes they're linked, you know?
Sometimes they're linked. Yeah. And really, I've had a bit of a paradigm shift, and instead of really bemoan what I might be losing in terms of this event, I've learned to have this, through wonder, really, this attitude of thankfulness and gratitude for what I've had so far. And I might be losing it, but I'm so blessed to have had it in the first place. And it's helped me to stay away from despair and really losing hope and really cling to the knowledge that things will happen.
Right. You
know? And it's amazing.
Anything that happens is a good thing. Renee.
Well, I've kind of blown my minute of wonder because that piece in the image journal really made me wonder. But I suppose I could extend it a little bit and say, when the poet was talking about how, you know, you're fully there and yet something is working through you and inspiring you, I have had moments in the classroom in the last week or so when I could see that the students who have been the most active, as I've said, outside of Parliament, and also we've had perpetual adoration in the cathedral, they were kind of looking for a point of, I could tell they were very agitated. And there was one moment in class yesterday when I was explaining the phenomenology of the body in Merleau-Ponty and in Carol Vautua, so John Paul II. And they were completely intrigued and everything went really, really silent. And I could see that they were all completely engaged and they were kind of taken out of themselves. And I thought, that's what liberal education is about. And that's why it's really, really important because they'll now go back re-energized for whatever it is that they need to do next. So I suppose that was my minute of wonder. My minute of wonder.
Mine's really boring and organic. I've taught a couple of weeks now into my semester of whole day classes on a Saturday. So that's a hardcore thing in itself. But I'm teaching marriage and sexuality and whole day classes. The first class, the air conditioning was stuffed and we were so hot in that room and we talked about really cool stuff and it was scripture and really interesting stuff, at least as far as I'm concerned. And I get really into it. And yet the class was a terrible experience because we were so hot. And then the next week they fixed the air conditioning.
And it was too cold.
And it was really pleasant beautiful. And it was almost the first time, the perfect temperature. And the whole class for me was philosophy. And that's not my forte and it's not as exciting, I believe, as scripture. And so I wasn't presenting, I don't think, as excited as I did in the first. And yet the experience was so much better. And I just, a moment of wonder for me was, wow, something as simple as, you know, 5 degrees changed the experience, even though all the other factors said you should go that way. And we're such a bodily beings. Yeah. It shouldn't have affected my thinking, but clearly it did. It shouldn't have affected everyone's experience of that classroom, but it really did. So, it was just about the wonder at the incarnation that we're so bodily in many respects that it just changes our attitudes. And it makes me check the air conditioning. All right. That's it for this week's podcast. If today's discussion got you thinking, arguing with your podcast device, if you've got artwork that you think we didn't discuss or that we got wrong.
We didn't discuss most of it.
Yes, indeed. You can subscribe to our podcast at thiscatholiclife.com.au on iTunes, Spotify, all the usual podcast platforms. And you can tell us what you liked, what you didn't like, what you'd like us to discuss in the future by dropping us a line at info@thiscatholiclife.com.au. Thank you very much, by the way, for all of those you have been contributing. We haven't been acknowledging you, and that's not fair because you've been giving us lots of feedback. I've been answering emails and Twitter feeds and other things, Facebook, and we really value your ideas, your feedback, positive and constructive. And we'd love to hear more from you. The ideas you've been sending in are great. We're working on building them into the show, so keep them coming. Also, don't forget to write us a review on iTunes or on whatever podcast device you're using. But if we get enough of those reviews, more people see us who normally wouldn't. So that's an important thing. This is a uniquely Australian podcast, and we think that's a great idea and an important thing for us Aussies to get out there and talk about ordinary life in an extraordinary way, which is through our Catholic faith. We want to thank you, the listener, for tuning in and those who supported us by leaving kind words. But now it's time for specific shout-outs. So, Ryan.
Artists, my fellow creatives in the diocese, yeah. And awesome. Around the world, I guess. Yeah. Shout out.
Good stuff.
Yep. Shout out to my students. If you haven't been able to tell by now, I love you all.
It is the high point of being a lecturer. Yeah, there's lots of other parts of life. That's the high point.
Yeah, that's right.
I want to shout out to some mates in America who actually have just released their 101st podcast, The Armchair Catholic in Lansing Diocese in the northern edge of the United States, I believe. Now they're going to correct me in my geography. Mm-hmm. But thank you very much, guys. You were an inspiration early on when we were thinking about this podcast, and I listened to you regularly, and they were very, very kind and gave me some good constructive criticism of the podcast and also some help along the way. So thank you, guys, and check them out, guys, The Armchair Catholic. That's all for now. Thank you for listening to This Catholic Life.